Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Forecast is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Forecast is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/TWiT.
What sort of future do you think we're heading for? How will we live as we slip into the 21st century?
Welcome to Forecast, episode 113. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Scott Johnson. 113, what the heck, man?
Lucky 113.
Oh, man, that's a lot of numbers right there. Three digits. And, of course, we're still just blazing a new trail in future prediction with wonderful guests, I'm assuming, we have today.
I am assuming as well, because I know. Actually, I don't have to. There's no assuming. I'm not making an ass out of you or me. When I welcome Steven Schleicher, executive producer of MajorSpoilers.com and host of the Critical Hit podcast. Welcome, Steven.
Thank you. And I think I'll probably make an ass for all of us.
Thank you. Appreciate that. That lets George off the hook. He is also with us. George Corley, word defender for the morning stream and producer and moderating host of the Con Langery podcast. We just read one of his emails on TNT minutes ago on the network. Welcome, George.
Yeah. That's surprising. I'm kind of on two of your shows back.
I know,
back.
Right?
It's kind of fun.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. And he's defending words every morning on TMS, so he is getting around, this guy.
Now, real quick, before we move into the predictions, a lot of people probably don't know what Con Langery means, and it's a cool concept. Explain what it means.
Okay, so this is something that has... Con Langing is basically creating a invented language. So Con Lang comes from constructed plus language. And it's basically, there's a whole community of people who create languages. You know, people here would know about, you know, Tolkien. That's sort of the kind of thing that a whole bunch of people are doing on the internet. And so at some point I decided, you know, there was one podcast that was publishing about every 6 months about it that was run by the Language Creation Society. And I'm like, This community really deserves a podcast. So I started Con Langery, and it is focused on basically every week we do sort of, it could be a creative process kind of topic. It could be more of a linguistics topic, and we review a Con Lang.
Awesome. I just think that's a fascinating subject and one that is worth checking out. So go to conlangery.com if you're interested. Let's get a prediction from one of our listeners. Casey B. sent us this email, says, by 2050, the average person will have basically created a life narrative based on everything they've ever posted or done online. Conversations, photos, videos, interests, purchase histories, relationships, et cetera, et cetera. It's all online. So with this data, I predict that a new therapy will emerge in the medical field for patients with memory loss, amnesia, and other forms of brain trauma. I'll call it digital restoration therapy, where doctors will have a program that could instantly capture and index everything that exists about a person online. This is then organized, reconstructed, and injected directly into the brain, effectively restoring a patient's personality, behaviors, habits, and life memories. It's like carbonite for your head. He says, perhaps by then Facebook's timeline will contain just about everything that would be needed to reconstruct personality and made available to doctors via an API.
Interesting. We're going to have to sort of license that technology. This is a great idea. Let's forget again, once again this week, let's forget about the nefarious use of this technology for a minute and how people would hack it and ruin it for the rest of us. But the idea that I could just say, snapshot what I am now, or what I was up until the time, you know, I got into this horrible traumatic brain accident, and then just have it all come back, that's a brilliant idea. In fact, I'm a little surprised we haven't had this prediction before. Probably the date seems off to me. I think 2050 seems way too close. I think that this is something that's going to take longer than that. I could be totally wrong. I realize it's a big chunk of time, but it does feel like, you know, as we get more and more advanced, we slow down the revolutionary advancements, and it seems to pan out a little bit longer. So I would probably tack another 50, maybe 30 years on that. But, you know, in time, this seems like a reasonable direction we're heading. Who knows?
I'm going to be careful and not use Apple, because when I look at iCloud and I have all these songs in my playlist that are not eligible for iCloud, I worry what memories they would not allow. Sorry. This memory duplicates a memory of an Apple staff member. We will not allow it.
Right.
Stephen, what think? You want the ability to have your brain restored?
It would be great if that could happen, where it was just a kind of a plug-and-play application. But, you know, there's also some of this going on right now. A coworker of mine just had a massive heart attack back in December, and they're doing some therapy with him where they've got all these digital pictures that they've taken of work, of his friends, of everybody, and he just sits there on the iPad all day long and just looks at the pictures, and he's starting to remember people and starting to remember events. So for that kind of thing, I probably agree with Scott. It'll probably happen, probably not by 2050, though. Probably a few more years out to do that plug and play.
Yeah, I don't know why that seems so short. It doesn't seem very far away to me for some reason.
Well, it's 38 years. So
yeah,
you'll be 42.
Well, I'm looking at the date. I'm looking at the last, say, 38. And I just don't feel like that. A lot happened, but on the larger scale, I don't know if that much happened. I mean, we're still kind of birthing babies the same. We have slightly better technology to see the baby ahead of time, as one medical example. We've come a long way with MRIs and things like that. So there are definitely big advancements in technology and in medicine, but it doesn't seem like it was that radical from the 40 years previous to that. The 40 years previous to that were huge jumps. And then we just kind of went, and we kind of evened off this long tail thing. And that's the only reason I think that. It just doesn't seem like that much time is that revolutionary anymore. And this feels pretty revolutionary. It'll be interesting to see if it comes from private medicine or if it comes from government investment, if it comes from some other source. Like where how do we get to the point where we can store that much data and have all the nuances of a human being's personality and current state of being, and then have that in a safe backed up form that can be easily tied into by doctors anywhere. I mean, that just feels like a longer draw to me. For
why were all your examples about babies?
I don't know exactly. That's really weird.
Do you have something to tell us?
I haven't had babies. Well, I mean, my kids are all, my youngest is 11 now. And
why.
My oldest are, I guess I'm, maybe I miss the babies. I don't know. But I know why it's on my mind, because my sister just had a baby.
Oh, okay. And well, that makes sense.
In her case, you know, 100 years ago, the baby would have died because she had her baby, Peter, was born with his intestines on the outside.
Oh, wow.
And it's a common, not common, but it is a common thing, or when it happens, we have very common procedures now to take care of it. So there's a huge jump for her if you look at the last 100 years. But the last 30 or so years, 38, 40 years, they would have done roughly the same thing 38 years ago as they would have done today.
Well, it's Mad Men era, right? 38 years ago, roughly. Yeah.
We just got real good real fast in industrialized society and now information society, that we've gotten to a point where I just don't think we can make those kinds of huge jumps as quickly, is all I'm getting at. And you know, who knows? Babies of the future may never have any complications, and you know, it may change completely, and I have no idea, but it just seems like that's a long time.
George, do you have any worries or concerns about your impending brain restoration?
Well, the thing is, the prediction that you read, from what I understand, was he was thinking about you would reconstruct everything from basically what's on your Facebook timeline. I kind of wonder how well that would actually work. I don't think I want just like all these status updates to be uploaded in my head.
I think he's expecting the timeline will have expanded by then.
You think he thinks like we'll actually be putting our memories onto the timeline?
He says
like,
perhaps
directly?
Facebook's timeline will contain just about everything that would be needed to reconstruct personality.
Okay, maybe if you could distill that. What I want is just the whole brain backup. Where they just take a full image of my brain and store that, and then they can reflash my brain, so to speak, or even, you know, put me on a computer.
Well, there's some good fiction out there which posits the ability to reconstruct a personality based on what is known about it. I think that's what Casey is referring to here, mm-hmm. is the idea that you could go on the internet and find out everything about a person and then construct an artificial intelligent version of that person and then put it back in that person because they have lost those memories themselves. In fact, that's from Alistair Reynolds' Blue Remembered Earth. One of the characters is a grandmother who's, you know, the beginning of the book, she dies, and they create a simulation of her because she had some secrets. And so they use all the publicly known information about her to create a simulation that they can then ask and try to see if it can figure out what some of those secrets were.
I just hope no one photoshops me standing next to Lincoln and tries to force that back into my brain, or I'm in real trouble.
Yeah, and can you, like, it's just that, yeah, you can reconstruct a personality, but can you put that personality into a form that could then be sent right back into my brain? That's
yes.
the thing.
Yes, you can. No, I don't know.
You know, that has some big implications for cloning.
But
you're thinking about cloning somebody's body and then, you know, creating a younger me and injecting all of my memories right into that younger body. I mean, we've seen that. What was that movie? The Sixth Day or whatever with Arnold Schwarzenegger? Along that lines.
Yeah, that movie was horrible. I remember that one.
Well, yeah.
bad movie. But yeah, your point is well made. I just feel like if we ever want to get anywhere with, say, really helping people with Alzheimer's, it's this tech. We've got to get closer to this technology. This is the end game for dealing with late in life, dementia, loss of memory, whatever it may be. And, you know, you could easily see a therapeutic form of this kick in for grandma or great grandma when she starts to experience that, or maybe has, you know, Alzheimer's patients in general start to have the symptoms that they have. How would it be to have like a nightly treatment? And this treatment involved just going to bed like normal, but attaching electrodes that during the night will refresh the bits that have gone away, and it's smart enough to know where to fill in the gaps. And then you've got a full day of good memory, of feeling vibrant and ready. And some of that starts to tip off at the end of the day. You just do another treatment. I mean, this doesn't seem that crazy. And if you went back a couple hundred years and explained to people the kinds of things that we're able to restore today, they would not believe us. It would sound as much magic as what I had just said. So this email is good. This is the right direction. I'm sure we'll get to something like this eventually. I think names like Facebook and stuff at that point will have nothing to do with the conversation, but something like what he's imagining, you know, the way that Star Trek does it in a way, will be a reality one day. I'm sure of it.
You know, it's funny. We always talk about, like, well, progress this, progress that. And we have progressed in a lot of ways, and we're still progressing in amazingly fast ways. But I have been thinking recently, we are in retrograde in a few areas. Less than 10 years ago, we could fly at supersonic speeds across the Atlantic Ocean. We don't offer that service anymore. We also regularly sent a shuttle into space that was a reusable craft that could service an international space station. We don't offer that service anymore. Houses were worth more in the past than they are now. I mean, we've gone back in time. I think time is flowing in reverse.
Ooh, weird. Do you feel like...
I feel younger.
Does that mean we're headed for the big crunch?
Maybe that's it. That's why you've hit it, George. We're headed back to the big crunch.
We're still going to get smaller and more scrunchy, and yeah. Maybe it does seem like we get, like, I always thought the whole dirigible period because of a few unfortunate events. I think that should have carried on. We should have giant advanced airships today.
Well, they do in the alternate universe.
Well, sure. That all carried on, and steam was really the primary source of power. But now it would be great for me to say, oh, we got to make a trip back east. What do you want to do? Well, let's take the dirigible and just go in this huge, you know,
dirigible.
Hot air thing.
I refuse. Zeppelins for me only.
I would love that. Oh, my gosh, I would love it. The idea that the sky would be full of those and that they were relatively safe. That's the thing, is we gave up on them because of a couple of really high-profile problems, you know, the Hindenburg being one of them. And everybody just went, oh, crap, we can't do this anymore. And I feel like, man, come on, you guys. So the supersonic speed thing, I don't know if that's the same reason, but we're kind of doing it with NASA and with space travel. We're kind of backing off a little bit. And I don't think that's good for humanity. We should be reaching out all the time, not always scrunching back.
Well, KCB, well done provoking a good conversation. Be like KCB and send us your predictions. You can post them up at our blog, forecastpodcast.com, or send them via electronic mail. Huh. That's something we didn't have 10. Oh, yeah, we did. forecastpodcast@gmail.com. That is the email address. Thank you, KCB. All right, we're going to get to our guest predictions here in a second, but want to thank our sponsor, Netflix.com. It's like the future. All the movies and TV shows you want streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. Like, you know, you couldn't do this 10 years ago, could you? You had to wait for those DVDs to come via pony to your house. Well, now you can stream things to your Xbox, to your Nintendo Wii, to your PS3, to your Mac, your PC, your iPad. All the movies or TV shows they have, you can watch for one low monthly price. And that low monthly price is free for the first 30 days if you go to Netflix.com/twit. Or if you have a friend who wants to try Netflix, use that URL, Netflix.com/twit. We thank them for their support of Tech News Today. Stephen, we'll start with you looking into your crystal ball. What is exactly going to happen in the future?
Well, it's real interesting. I've been watching Kickstarter, and I know a lot of people have had great success with Kickstarter, especially in the comic book area. And we have seen in the independent film area, and possibly in the future, as Jason Calacanis had said, maybe a major director will go to Kickstarter to start a campaign. I think as we get into an era of comic books, being a comic book guy and running a comic book website, that we're going to actually see in the next couple of years a major publishing company, could be Marvel, could be DC, could be Dark Horse, are actually going to go to a Kickstarter campaign to fund a limited miniseries starring a fan favorite. I mean, we're always seeing titles getting canceled because of low numbers and, you know, those 3,000, 5,000 fans going, oh, I wish that you would continue telling great stories with Man-Thing or whatever. And I think we're going to get to the point where the companies are going to see some profit in that and say, well, okay, if you guys want to see a 6-issue limited series of Green Arrow or whatever it may be, here's how much money we need. Here are the creators that are going to be involved, and here's what you get in return for that. And I think we're going to, I think in the next couple of years, we're actually going to see that happen with the publishing companies.
So do you think, do you feel like there's going to be any sort of full-on co-opting of the crowdsourcing as their primary way of getting projects off the ground? For example, if, I don't know, let's say Image Comics, they get their board of directors together. I don't even know how they're organized now because it's a lot different back when they started.
Right.
With, you know, Todd and the whole crew and Jim Lee and everybody kind of having their creator-owned stuff. But do you see a day where they decide, you know what, it's better, instead of us just fronting all this money every time when we find a creator we like and backing him, let's have the world front the money. We'll facilitate all of the, you know, they're going to make sure the supply chain works and however you get it to print slash digital and all that. And they've got all the ties and all the connections to comic book shops and all this other stuff. And really, it's just up to the world to decide whether they want that. And maybe the, I guess, breadth of distribution is determined by how much support they get.
Yeah, exactly.
What are the downfalls of that? Like, I'm having a hard time thinking of a reason why they won't do this. This seems like a really good idea.
DC just relaunched their entire line, and they had, in the last couple of weeks, last month or so, they've canceled six of those titles. Well, six of those titles are big favorites of many readers, Static Shock, OMAC, and so on. If fans really want that series to continue, instead of wasting that money, say, okay, fans, it's going to cost, let's just make up an imaginary number, $100,000. And if you want a 6-issue limited series, here's $100,000. Here are some perks that you get based on the different levels that you do it. Once it reaches the amount that we are hoping to achieve, we will release that. Those of you that have contributed, depending on your sponsorship level, you'll either get the 6 issues or you'll get one copy or however many copies that you've fronted ahead of time. And then based on that, who knows? The company could continue to do that, releasing additional miniseries as you go along. Otherwise, you know, if there's no interest, then the company's justified in saying, hey, look, nobody wants to buy OMAC. Nobody wants to buy Avengers or whatever title that you want to be or publish. And then they can move on with it. I mean, DC really kind of proved this point a few years ago with the Manhunter series, where they canceled Manhunter, and then there was this huge fan base that said, we want Manhunter back, we want Manhunter back. And so DC said, okay, fine, we're going to bring Manhunter back. And within, I think it's like 3 or 4 issues, the numbers had tanked so far that they had to say, we're canceling again. And the fans say, we want it back, we want it back. They came back and put it as an 8-page backup in a series, and I forget which one it was. But even that wasn't very successful. And so DC finally, after 3 tries, said, look, there's just not enough fan support for an ongoing Manhunter series. Well, if you were doing a crowdsourced or crowd-backed campaign, you would know exactly how many people are interested in this book, whether it's successful or not.
Right. Maybe this is a great way to figure out if characters need to be even being in your lineup at all, right? Like, I know there are a few DC 52s right now that are getting cut. Right. In fact, you told me. Give me an example. What's one of those getting
cut? OMAC is cut. Static Shock is cut. I forget the other ones. Planetary, I think, is being cut back.
So if you look at, like, Static Shock's a good example. Let's say that you... So what they had to do to find that out is they had to hire the artists, they had to hire the writers, and they had to put out a book, and they had to see it fail to know whether or not this would work. So, yeah, your idea is a good one. Let's see if there's interest out there. Not only that, maybe there's enough interest to do a smaller run or, you know, whatever, something smaller.
Well, and that's the other thing that I think is going to happen, too, is that we're going to see, instead of long ongoing series where we're going to end up having 500, 600, 900 issues, I think we're going to see the approach that the Atomic Robo guys do, where they release a series of limited series. So they're getting ready for volume 6 coming out, I think, this week or next.
Oh, is it this
week?
I love that series.
I think it is. And what they've done is, here's volume 1, here's volume 2, here's volume 3. They're self-contained stories. There's 5 or 6 issues a piece. And when it's done, it's done. And if it's successful, they'll continue and make another one. If it's not, then that's the end of Atomic Robo. Heaven forbid that happens. But
I think this is a model that could be experimented with by a lot of industries, not just comics. I think about the write-in campaigns for shows getting canceled on television, sci-fi saying no more Stargate Universe and the fans erupting. Is there really enough interest? Right, it's always a debate between the fans who say, look at all of us complaining, of course there's enough interest, and sci-fi going, hey, we're looking at the ratings and we just can't sell it.
Well, the rating system is screwed up by itself. But
exactly.
I mean, that's what it is.
So this is sort of
your money where your mouth is.
This is your way station on the way. I say, okay, we don't think it's worth saving, but we're going to put it up on Kickstarter. Put your money where your mouth is. Are there enough of you willing to plop down? Then we'll make it, like a direct download or something. You could use this for a lot of different industries. George, is this sparking any ideas for you? Do you like this idea?
Yeah, I like it. I like the main point that he raises is that Mr. Schleicher is raising is that I like is that these are properties that would otherwise be canceled. And then, just like you were saying, it is you are asking the fans to put some of their own money in that, which gives them a little bit more buy-in into it than just, railing against people on the forums. Anybody could do that, but do you really want it enough to actually spend some money on it and, give us a little of something you have of value for us to give you that thing?
Yeah, I like this. I don't think Kickstarter or things like it replace any part of the chain necessarily. I think they give smaller folks a chance to get started in a way that they never could before. So they're creating something entirely new. And I don't think the large companies have really explored what they can do with Kickstarter. And that's why I love your idea, Stephen. It's saying, like, all right, this is another option for us. And it's a very low-risk option. That's why it appeals to the smaller publishers and smaller ideas, because they don't have the money to risk. Mm-hmm. And it says, put your money where your mouth is. Don't do a write-in campaign. Don't go on the forums and complain. Put $5, $10, $15 down here and let us know that you're willing to really back this. Love it.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, to see comics continue to thrive and be strong, this model is going to have to keep evolving. And it's starting to seem like, and Stephen, we've talked about this 100 times together, but this idea that the companies themselves are starting to see it. It isn't just us going, you guys, we live in a digital world. Print is changing. It's weird. We're also seeing comic books shift their weight and say, all right, this huge room we used to dedicate to just wall-to-wall comics is now wall-to-wall board games and D&D and Warhammer. And we're going to make this place a place to come and congregate and have fun with your friends. And in the back, we're going to have a pretty good selection still of comics. But we're also going to do a lot of sort of special ordering for you if you want a series. Or we're going to give away digital codes. Or we're going to tie ourselves into Comixology or whatever. So as the companies at the top, the publishers, all the way down to the stores themselves, and ultimately down to us, we are seeing this business change, and we've got to figure out, I mean, this is a kind of a plea almost, we've got to figure out a way to make it work, because it's an art form I do not dare see leave. It's something I really, really cherish, and surely you do. I mean, this is a big deal for you and Major Spoilers and the stuff you're into.
Mm-hmm. And the good thing is it's no risk, because if it doesn't meet the funding option, you're not out the money. The company's not out any money or work. So it's, I think it's a win-win.
Ralph in the chat room brings up a good point. Let's apply this logic to the ending of Mass Effect 3.
they should fund BioWare to make a new ending, you mean?
Yeah, BioWare says, look, we will change that. We'll make it downloadable content to change the ending of Mass Effect 3 if we get we raise $1 million on Kickstarter. I think they'd raise it. I really do.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
you could do it.
Let's think about that. I mean, there are enough people that they're unhappy with it that you would probably have some groundswell. Some have said that the freak out over that ending is super vocal minority. Now, I've got the game and I haven't finished it yet, and I can't say for sure. But we've got mutual friends who've beaten it. Veronica Belmont beat it and says, I don't know what people are talking about. I love my
ending. Well, no, that's not what she said. She said, I understand what people are talking about, but I didn't bother me.
Oh, okay. Well, and that's maybe even more of a, that's another piece of granularity to this that's hard to deal with. But it's such a subjective experience. But so are comics. So are a lot of things. So if we don't like the way, I mean, here's a good example. What if Batman goes down some crazy path that nobody, you know, a majority of people really don't like?
Or what if George Lucas decides to make a movie that just offends everyone and ruins their childhood memories?
That's what
he would never do that, would he?
Should be. It should be to fund a reshooting of the prequels there.
Well, at the very least, it could fund things like standalone film projects and say, all right, well, you guys want a new Star Wars movie. I'm too, I don't know, old and don't want to do this anymore, says George Lucas. So we're going to give it in your hands and you're going to get to help us pick director and you're going to help us pick the right smart people. It's not like they're saying to us, you make the movie and we'll see if we'll play it. Although that's an interesting part of, you know, socializing this as well. But I love the idea of me being able to say, yes, I will throw $100 at this project. Because, I don't know, Ridley Scott's directing or some crazy idea like that. And I love the screenwriter. And let us be part of that process. I'll bet you'd end up with a really good Star Wars movie. Or the flip side is you may end up with way too many cooks in the kitchen and end up with a really bad one. I don't know. Yeah.
You can take that approach with, have you guys seen that blog cabin that they run on the DIY network where people go in and vote on the floor treatment, the color scheme, and those kinds of things, and it's a community source kind of project, but the end result is a finalized product that actually looks pretty good.
Interesting. All right, George, it's time to turn it over to you. You have the crystal ball stick or something like that. What is your what is your prediction for the future?
Yeah, well, I have several here, but I'll go with the first one here. Since you introduced me with a bunch of language stuff, I'm going to do a language one.
Cool.
You've had people predicting things about the future of English before. I think mine's going to be a little bit different. I think that, first of all, English as a global lingua franca is going to wane. I don't know what will replace it or if it's going to need to be replaced.
You're not going to jump to Chinese like everyone else does?
Well, I already speak Chinese, but anyway.
No, I'm just saying, everyone says English will decline and Chinese will become the lingua franca.
That's hard to predict. It may. But I think after that happens, English is going to fracture into different languages. However, it's going to be sort of a similar situation to what Arabic is today, and to some extent Chinese as well, in that, especially in the countries that have more stronger British roots, like U.S., Canada, Britain, of course, Australia, those countries, they will sort of culturally think of themselves as all speaking English. And it may be that the standards stay fairly close, but what people speak on the street will be effectively different languages.
Interesting. Don't we have we have examples of this now, right? There are societies and cultures where there's maybe a nationally recognized language, but on the street, like it's very different. I know when I spent a little bit of time in China, and there was a language that everybody seemed to speak in formal situations, but when you got them to a restaurant or on their own or when they were just with friends or family, it changed. And they tried to explain it to me and I was oblivious to any of it. So it was really hard for me to get in edgewise, but it did seem like that was already sort of happening.
You were in Shenzhen, right? most of the time.
Shenzhen City, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, probably a lot of people out on the street would have been speaking Cantonese, whereas in more formal situations, people would speak Mandarin.
Yeah.
Is this?
Yeah, and I got... Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Stephen.
I was going to say, how is this different from... you know, the Queen's English and American English and Australian English. Are we talking about the same thing? Are we talking about slang? Are we actually talking about an actual different form of English or Chinese or whatever it may be?
Well, think about, so American English and British English, you can understand a British person fine, right?
Yeah,
it's not
to an extent, yes.
And that's the
except
actual
for Terpster,
test
yeah.
for, yeah, that's the actual technical test that linguists use. And it's a little fuzzy, but basically whether a speaker of one variety and a speaker of the other variety can understand each other. My idea is that there may be standards so that highly educated people in all the Anglophone countries will still be able to talk to each other. But out on the street, most people will speak languages that they wouldn't be able to understand what's spoken on the street in London. At least people here would not be able to understand that. Do you understand my meaning? So
yeah,
basically,
yeah.
It would
I don't
diverge,
know. Are you speaking
the
English?
The lower forms would diverge.
No, I definitely see what you're saying. It's not about accents. It's not about slang. It's about the fracturing of the language, which something of an example, and I know you'll correct me here because it's not exactly an example of what you're talking about, but I think for our audience to wrap their heads around it, it's the similarity between Italian, Spanish, and French, right? When you look at those written languages, you can tell, well, they all have Latin as a root because they share a lot of what are called cognates. But if a French person speaks to an Italian person and they haven't studied each other's language, it's very difficult for them to understand what the other person is saying. They are, in fact, different languages. So what you're suggesting is that English would diverge in that way so much that there would be different usages, different pronunciations, and we wouldn't be able to understand each other. But the argument against that I always hear is that because of the internet and worldwide communications, that we are less likely for that to happen because we're not isolated from each other enough for the languages to fracture. So what do you think is going to push that fracturing of the languages? Because good examples would be places like Jamaica, where they have sort of a pidgin English that is almost indistinguishable from a foreign language. In fact, a lot of people can't understand
Jamaican Creole, I think.
Yeah.
And I think Jamaican it's like English words, but the grammar comes from another language. But I don't know the details, but. It would be sort of what I'm thinking of is Arabic is a good example because it's another language that's spread across multiple countries due to a big empire. And basically what occurs in Arabic is you have a standard language that is based on the Quran and so educated people and people who are sort of in the know. And a lot of people will have some level of competency in that standard, but Egyptian Arabic and Iraqi Arabic and Saudi Arabic are basically different. Maybe sort of there will be like an internet register where people who are on the internet all the time know very well this particular standard, and everybody will have some competency in it. But in your day-to-day goings on, around, you know, the neighborhood, you speak and something entirely different.
Wow, that's intense. What do you know about the Korean language, by the way? Much?
A
little bit.
Not a lot, but I know that Hangul is very interesting. But
all right. Well, I bring it up because I have a brother who came to the States when he was 10. He was adopted into our family when he was 10 years old from an orphanage, and he never quite lost his accent and also his connection to the language. He stayed very studied up on it and that sort of thing. He spent a bunch of time here, grew to about the age of 20 or so, went back to spend some time in Korea. So now, you know, 10 years in the States, basically, you know, 11 years in the States, I guess. And he you know, kept up on it, brushed up on it, understood it, kept the vernacular sort of in the forefront. It was really important to him to do that as he grew up. He goes back, though, and everybody treats him like, this is more, maybe this is more of a culture question now that I hear myself asking it, but everyone treated him like he was some kind of weird subspecies, like he was terrible, like he shouldn't be coming back there. What a traitor. It was this really weird kind of thing. Is language so, what's the word? Is it so much part of who, how we behave and not just how we communicate that we can't, that it's impossible, at least for some cultures, to see past the point of, oh, well, he spent some time somewhere else, so he's rusty by our standards, therefore he should be, you know, treated like an outsider or whatever. Is that a thing you see in a lot of languages? And does the language itself have an impact on how much or little of that happens with people?
Well, language is certainly very, very much intertwined with culture. So that could be something about, you know, if he's not as fluent as in Korean as he used to be, people might look down on him because, you know, he went away and he's less Korean because he's lost this connection with his culture. I think your brother, he was adopted by your family, right, during Korean War. And I think I've heard you say before that there's some feelings associated just with that whole process, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the short of it is he came in the 80s, so it was well after the Korean War, but he was it was kind of in the aftermath of all that. This was pre-Olympics. Yeah, yeah. Pre sort of Korea becoming an important financial power in the East, and okay. There was a lot of orphan problems and all that. So yeah, there's a lot of all those sorts of things are tangled in this as well.
Yeah, I think that might actually be the answer, is that all these different sort of emotions and resentments are tied up in this. People use language as a proxy for other feelings all the time. So they may. Whether his Korean is really worse than someone who's lived in Korea all their life or not, people may like pick on any little mistake and say, oh, you are one of those people who bailed out when Korea was still a developing country and we don't like you and the way you speak is dumb.
Right. Right. And the only reason I really brought it up is to the prediction, it seems like there will be those kinds of things are going to make a difference, you know. And we're going to get fiercely protective of whatever our language of origin is, and having it change and get tweaked is probably going to be a point of contention, no matter who's, you know, who ends up being dominant and who doesn't. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds.
Yeah, that's why I had the idea of it was, and this is not just my idea. This is just something that floats around. It's happened to other languages, but. That's why I was thinking of it. We would have this illusion that we all speak the same language just because of the strong cultural ties we have.
Right.
But in fact, it would be different languages offline, is what you're saying?
Yeah. It's, I don't know. It's getting more and more complicated to unpack, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. Stephen, what do you think? You think English is going to fracture? Do you think we'll get a universal language? Where do you think this is going?
I don't know if we'll have a universal language. And Tom, I know you're well-read and you're probably
except
very
for
familiar
love.
With... well, yeah, the universal language of love and music. Didn't in Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, or at least how they presented it in Blade Runner, didn't they have a street language that was a mixture of Chinese and English and Spanish, and it was just like you were dropping words in left and right? But then when you were talking formally, then you were speaking, you know, English. And so I could see something like this happen very easily, and it won't be culture-based. It's just going to be how are we going to communicate in order to understand one another to complete a transaction or to complete a desire or whatever it may be. So I think there's some good thinking behind that.
Well, and it may not, you know, I may be stuck thinking about it regionally, but you bring up a really good idea, which is that here is an example from fiction, but plausible, that there is a street language that people use and there is a formal language, and that has roots in Latin being used in exactly the same way. In fact, what ossified it, a lot of people think, is that it became too formal and people didn't ever use it in daily life. Mm-hmm. And it may be that English as a formal language with formal rules continues as that sort of formal language, but it's not regional dialects that develop, but right. but cultural dialects. So the 4chan version of English breaks off on its own, and the script kiddie version breaks off on its own, and the Warcraft player version breaks off on its own. And instead of it being associated to regions, it's associated to cultural groups. That could be fascinating.
That makes sense, because different cultural groups do sort of alter the language to their own things. Obviously, I'm in a community that has created a whole bunch of basically technical terms. If I got into hardcore talking about conlanging, you might, like every other word, not understand. And just all sorts of different things. It doesn't have to be regional. There are dialects associated with socioeconomic status. There's dialects associated with men versus women in languages around the world. So it could be split up in different ways other than just regions. That was just the first thing I was thinking of.
I mean, I'm going to LFR tonight on my rubber chicken, Scott. That means something to you. It may not mean something to everybody else.
That's true. I know exactly what you're talking about. And you should be doing that tonight. Good job.
All right, let's check our watches, Scott. I believe it's 4 past questions.
Holy heck, it is. It's time for 4 questions. If you don't know what that is, well, fine listeners and our fine guests, it is a chance for us to ask 4 questions of each of our guests. They're not allowed to think too hard about it. They must answer from the gut. And I'll be asking my questions today of Mr. Steven Schleicher. Steven, are you sitting comfortably?
Yeah, reasonably.
All right, well, here you go. Here are your 4 questions. Will we ever get a new Spawn movie, and will it be any good?
Yes, we will, and it will be as good as people are willing to fund it.
All right, I agree. It seems to fit nicely with your prediction.
Kickstart my Spawn.
Todd Kickstarter. Spawn and Kickstarter are kind of synonymous, so it's kind of weird. Spawn starter. Anyway, in the year 2345, when can we all draw whatever we want? Or I'm sorry, not that's not a question. In the year 2345, when we can all draw whatever we want just by thinking it, will that be the true death of comic books forever?
No, because there will still be a creative exchange where people have to give you feedback. So the creation itself is not the end. It is the consumption and then the feedback that completes that loop.
Oh, man, you have solved so many problems with that one statement. Very nice. If Michael Bay, Brett Ratner, and M. Night Shyamalan co-directed a movie together in the future, what would it be called?
Teenage Mutant Elevator from Hell. Farcical. No one buys a ticket.
Farcical. Awesome. Nicely done.
That's well done. And then finally, your 4th question. Let's see. A reminder that we still don't have our jetpacks. When do we all get our jetpacks?
In the year 2222.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And then we won't call them jetpacks. We will call them exhaust ports.
All right, because they'd be built in? Is that
I was going to say. They
built in.
Surgically implanted?
Oh, I have one of those now. Tom, I hand the baton back to you.
What's with your jetpack? I went to Chipotle. All right. George, are you sitting comfortably?
As comfortably as I can.
Good, then we'll begin. Question number 1, if the world was inevitably going to be hit by an asteroid, how should we pick who gets to go into the bunker? Stop thinking and answer.
By size, how many people can we fit in the bunker?
Now, do we go largest to smallest?
Which now I realize that would end up putting me out because I'm 6'1", and got 2 because he's... What, you're 6'4"?
6'4".
Well, you do largest first, and then just...
You could, and then maybe fit the smaller people in between. That's going to be some tight packing, isn't it?
Yeah. All right, question number 2. Where are the secret off-planet government bases?
Dark side of the moon, of course.
Yeah, of course.
And
thank
there's
you.
One on Pluto, but...
That's not a planet. Know. I didn't specify they had to be on planets, by the way. It's perfectly logical.
It doesn't have to be a planet, does it?
No, definitely not. Question number 3, will we ever perfect cows in space so we can have fresh milk on Mars?
Yes, and they will be green, and the milk will be blue.
Ooh, sweet.
Oh, and then on the moon, we could have green cheese.
Mmm.
Because you just
so blue, so blue
little
milk,
yellow
so
food coloring, coloring into the blue milk. And bingo.
Blue milk, that means they're just going to skim then, great. Right? Just skim. Sorry, I hate skim milk so bad. And if you look at a bottle of skim milk, it's freaking blue. It's also semi-transparent. Continue.
Blue-haired old ladies drink skim milk. Question number four. When the aliens arrive, what language will they speak?
They will speak language that is completely incomprehensible and unlearnable by us. And they also will not be able to learn our languages, so they will just blow us up.
Wrong. The answer is French. No, I'm just kidding. your answer is perfectly plausible. Yeah, exactly. Fear the aliens. Listen to Stephen Hawking and George Corley. They've warned you. And that's the end of our show. Thank you all for joining us. It's brilliant having you both along today for another fantastic edition of Forecast. Stephen Schleicher, let folks know about MajorSpoilers.com. What's going on over there?
Pop culture, comic books, everything that people want to know about in those industries. We talk about it every day. We love it so much, and we want to see it continue. So we help spread the word.
And, of course, George, you explained to us at the beginning a little bit about what Conlang is. And conlangery.com is the place for your podcast. Any news, any special events coming up, special episodes you want to plug?
Not really. I'll just say our latest episode is all about getting rid of adjectives or making them less prominent in your language. And also we are reviewing Lojban, which some of your audience might be interested in. It's a popular language for the computer geeks. So.
A beautiful, thrilling, and special episode. Except with, if you get rid of those adjectives, it's just an episode of conlangery.com. Thank you, George. Great having you on the show, man.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Scott Johnson, always a pleasure to have you on the show because you're my co-host. And I
it's my
be here
pleasure, Tom. It's always only, it's all my pleasure. I think we ought to mention this on the 28th of this month. That is a week from this Wednesday, a week from 2 days from now. You and I are launching a new project, a new show called Autopilot. I think people are going to love it. If you are into TV and you want to know the origins of everything, if you really want to know where some of this stuff started, some of the trivia you've never heard, and hear us talk about some really cool stuff. And if you're a fan of Film Sack, I think you'll like this format. Brand new show, autopilotshow.com. You can get it on iTunes right now. Subscribe early before they run out.
Yeah, right.
we're going to do it in season. So we've got a 12-episode season coming up, and it will start Wednesday. It'll be air weekly, and I'm totally stoked about it. So watch for that.
Yeah, the idea is that we give you a look at the pilot episodes and remark specifically on what's different from what the show ended up becoming, what's interesting, where the show could have gone if they'd kept certain elements, this and that. So it should be fun. Autopilotshow.com. Thanks, Scott.
Yep. You betcha.
And thank you for watching or listening. You can find us on the web at forecastpodcast.com or send us an email, forecastpodcast@gmail.com, and let us know your prediction. That's it for this episode of Forecast. We will see you in the future. Get it? Because it's Forecast and it's a show about the future. So that's why I said it that way.
Way.
Nice. Way. That's right. Don't forget the way. Pilots.
So on your autopilot show, are you guys going to look at any pilots that never developed into television series?
Oh, I think so, right, Tom? We've talked about this a little bit.
I think we're going to save that for a future season, maybe season two. Right, we'll do a special season of just failed pilots because somebody sent us, what was it, Pooch
something.
Ken with anyway, it was horrible. And I want to collect a good number of those. So the first season will definitely be successful pilots.
Okay.
Well, any podcast that has Tom Merritt and Scott Johnson is going to be a good one.
Well, so actually, we're getting people complaining. Now. They're like, the two of you do too many shows.
Yeah,
I can't possibly watch it.
Thing is, and we even know that, and we don't care. We're doing it anyway. But the beauty of it is, it's going to be. I mean, what I'm looking forward to, even just as even if I was just a listener of this, is finding out, well, why were there two Star Trek pilots, and where did that kind of fall apart, and why was Spock so pissed in the first episode? You know, all these kinds of things. And it's surprising how much trivia is out there, but also some of the hidden stuff's a little tricky to find. We hope to kind of find that and, you know, bring this stuff up and just geek out about it because that's stuff we love. And we also, I should tell this so the chat room knows this, we're endeavoring to see shows and watch episodes that are available in some form somewhere. So that's the other reason it's an advantage to do stuff that sort of succeeded. You're going to be able to get all of Star Trek on Netflix, for example, or on Amazon, I think has it now. And these various other, you know, resources for streaming content, because we want to, you know, we want to be able to share it with you. Have you guys sort of see it in advance, much like we do with FilmSack. Come listen to the episode and, you know, kind of be more of a part of it that way.
Yeah. So the show will be brought to you by lovefilm.uk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent.
No, I'm just
kidding. Well, I hope one of those is you guys look at the Buffy the Vampire Slayer pilot, because that was fascinating to see how the characters switched up and changed from that pilot episode, which is, I think, 30 minutes long to the list, way it originally aired.
No, it's not on the list, damn it.
It should be on the list. Yeah, I thought that one was for some reason. Why do I?
No.
You know what I'm thinking of? Firefly's on there.
I know. Isn't it? Here are the shows. Star Trek, Battlestar Galactica, Stargate SG-1, Quantum Leap, Mission Impossible, A-Team, Emergency, Buck Rogers, Sequest DSV, Life on Mars, Roswell, and Lost.
Excellent. Yes.
That's Puchinsky. A hell of a season right there. Puchinsky is the name of the failed
Puchinsky.
Pilot.
Okay.
Buffy, definitely. And Firefly's not on there either.
Yeah, we're going to put in like another season. We'll probably get Babylon 5's. Oh, someone just said that in the chat room even. That'll be there. Other Trek series, certainly. You know, I think probably the pilot to Enterprise deserves to be looked at, since that's such maligned series. I mean, there's so much, and we'll, you know, the reason we're doing it in series, it makes it easy for us to not only have a breakpoint, but it lets us be very careful about which 12 we do at a time. And I'm stoked about it. It's going to be great.